Hi, this is Amber, and welcome to today's podcast. The website is sacredspacehealing.org. That's sacredspacehealing.org. For those of you that are new to the channel, I'm a Reiki master teacher and a shamanic practitioner. I've been running my own healing practice since 2007, and these podcasts have been probably going for as long as that as well. My work is focused on core wound healing, life purpose, alignment, sacred union sessions, and abundance sessions, as well as one-to-one coaching and healing. And these podcasts are a way to reach as many people as possible and to offer some guidance along the way. The website, again, is sacredspacehealing.org. Do check it out. And there's meditations on there and other offerings, including blog posts as well, and things that you can download. And for those of you that are following the channel or have appreciated the podcasts, as I say, donate to appreciate. I'm not affiliated to anyone. I'm not going to try and sell you anything. I'm not run by some big organization. I don't have marketing and PR behind me. I'm not going to bring a bunch of famous people on to try and sway you that I'm somehow more talented or more of a guru than the next person. I'm not trying to be anyone's guru. I don't film the podcasts. I don't have fancy recording equipment, and that's not because I can't do that stuff or I don't know how to or I couldn't afford it, blah blah blah. It's mainly because I'm keeping it real. So it's like we're in a room together and we're having a conversation, and you will hear the birds singing, you'll probably hear doors slamming, you might hear my washing machine make some noise. It's to keep it really real, and also because I feel that spirituality is becoming a really hideous beast in terms of marketing and business. Everyone's jumping on the bandwagon, and it's just not my vibe. And I find it quite bizarre when people film themselves doing podcasts. I mean, I suppose I understand it because you can then subtitle it, but you could subtitle it without the image. And if they're doing it to make it more accessible, that's a beautiful thing. But somehow I feel that they're not doing it to make it more accessible, because there are other ways to make podcasts accessible for those who need it to be made accessible. And actually, in advance, I do apologize for that. It's something I'm looking into, is to how to make these podcasts more accessible. So for those who are maybe hearing impaired, and what can be done? And it might be about recording something, but I don't think it's going to be me sitting here with a camera on my face. I think it will probably be other images, but we can certainly get subtitles done. So that's all stuff that I am pondering away, but because I don't have a big marketing team behind me, it's just me trying to work out how to do it in the best way possible. Sometimes it takes a bit longer. But yes, if you would like to donate, this is a very long preamble, isn't it? If you'd like to donate, you can go to the website sacredspacehealing.org. There's a donations button. You can donate as much or as little as you feel called to, and all the money goes back into creating free content. You can also like or share the podcasts on social media. You can leave a nice review on iTunes or Spotify. Okay, so today I'd like to shine a light on toxicity and a form of sort of narcissism, probably, in South Asian families. It's been quite interesting. I've been following some really interesting accounts on social media, and I'm not a big social media fan, but I stumbled across some great ones to do with racism, and that sort of took me down some really interesting little rabbit holes, really, that took me into the South Asian experience. Because we, you know, I feel that we have a real lack of activism when it comes to South Asian racism, and also the South Asian experience in the UK and across the world. And I think a lot of that is to do with how South Asians are brought up and the families that they grow up in, and how that affects the way they then are out in the world. I mean, we're seeing a lot more than we ever were before, and I think a lot of South Asian people have actually taken their inspiration from the black community. You know, that kind of, they've gone to the music, they've gone to the culture. I know I did. You know, I know that when I was growing up, it was tricky to have, I mean, I do have South Asian heritage, so it was tricky for me to really bond with a lot of South Asian kids, because our experiences were actually so different. And I tended to bond more with international students, you know, students who were from other parts of the world. They weren't UK-based. who are very well travelled. And I tended to bond really well with the black kids in my school because we seemed to share more experiences in common and more ways of feeling different in the world than the South Asian kids. So I'm going to move on to toxicity in South Asian families, but just to kind of explore that a bit more, one of the reasons why it was so difficult for me, and I think this is an experience that many South Asians face, is that I didn't fit into the South Asian community because I wasn't really brought up in that way. So this sort of expectation, this kind of sort of a prejudice that lots of people have towards South Asians is that, you know, your mum wears a sari and you eat curry every night and you go to Southall, which is this place here in the UK, or East London, you know, and you love watching Bollywood movies and doing Bhangra, and your family's very close and chatty and over-loving and a little bit suffocating, and all of these things that are true for some South Asians, but I wasn't brought up that way. So for me, I wasn't part of that kind of, in many ways, suffocating community, the South Asian community. None of the members of my family, actually, even extended family, were ever brought up in that way in the UK. Because when they came to the UK, they, you know, they had very disparate diaspora experiences. It was very challenging in the 60s. There was a lot of racism. And also they wanted to fit in. Like, they didn't want to be ghettoized. And I think there's this idea that if you're from a South Asian community, that you're in your little ghetto. And I wasn't in a ghetto. So I didn't have that. So I didn't really fit in to the South Asian community because we were never really part of it. And possibly that's the immigrant experience sometimes, which people don't talk about. I was born here, but my parents came here to this country from other countries. And then I didn't fit in with the white community because I wasn't white. And there was a lot of racism when I was at school and I was growing up. People couldn't, you know, pronounce my name. People thought that my food smelled funny. People laughed at me for lots of different reasons. I felt very isolated. And I didn't fit in with the Asian girls because the Asian girls were part of that kind of clique. And I'm starting to hear from other South Asians now that this can be quite a common experience, that you're sort of not brown enough to be accepted by your own people and not white enough to be accepted by the white community. And that's sort of what it was like. And, you know, one of the things that we never really have talked about enough, I think, is the levels of racism and bigotry and harassment and toxicity within the South Asian community over colour of skin and caste and money and religion and all of these things, you know, which make it an even more difficult community to be a part of. Like, there's huge racism in the South Asian community. If you're fair, that's considered a good thing. And we know why that is. It's because there's this idea that if you're dark, it's because you were out working in the fields and therefore you weren't so rich. And, you know, I guess we trace it back to that. And of course, I don't have dark skin. And I've experienced a lot of jealousy and a lot of kind of envy and anger and rage within the South Asian community from other South Asians who don't like the fact that I'm fairer than them. And yet, within the white community, I'm too brown, I'm not white enough. Where are you from? Where are you from? Where are you from? So, I just want to explain a bit of the context of that. That's an experience for a lot of South Asians, has been, growing up. And that often, you know, for those reasons, they took their identity. They looked for identity within the black community because the black community, it seemed to me, I'm happy to be corrected, of course, 100%. But I know when I was growing up and as a teenager and, you know, my 20s and so on, the black community seemed to have a really strong identity with music or with culture or with food or with an attitude. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was like this kind of sass, this magic around the black community, that they were unapologetic, whereas the South Asian community to me were apologetic. And of course that's a huge generalization, but I'm just saying that often for South Asians, and I know it was the same for me, is that I took a lot of my inspiration from black music and black culture and black food and black fashion, you know, because they were doing it, they were out there living it fearlessly because they had to, because of their history, because of what they went through. And that because the South Asian history is different, because colonialism was different for South Asians, because it was almost like an uneasy pact with the oppressor, it didn't lead to that same fire. And so actually this does come full circle, because I think that uneasy alliance with your oppressor, the kind of shadowing, the overshadowing of colonialism, is very similar to the sort of toxicity and the narcissism that you see within South Asian families. And it's almost as if, you know, was it always there, or did it start during the time of colonialism and just get passed down because of the trauma of colonialism? I remember hearing horrific stories about the partition between India and Pakistan and the bloodbath that went on and the trauma of that, but also just the trauma of colonialism and what that did to the people of the land, what that did to women, children, what that did to families, women who were raped, children born of rape, men who lost their livelihoods, people being killed, the brutality that people experienced. The trauma of that then got passed down generationally, and has it become a form of toxicity and narcissism that is now kind of an epidemic within the South Asian community? South Asian families can be incredibly loving and supportive and warm, and there's, you know, this kind of stereotype, like we have stereotypes of the Jewish family, that, you know, it's all kind of great food being cooked and big hugs and extended families and so forth. But what there's also within South Asian families is a lot of narcissism and a lot of gaslighting and a lot of trauma bonding and guilt tripping and judgment and criticism. And I think what a lot of, it's a very shared experience that many, many South Asian children, if you like, you know, who grow up into adults, will then talk about their experiences with their parents. And the experiences will be very similar. And it's been interesting to hear these stories, because what they're experiencing is narcissistic parents, you know, parents that are so focused on themselves, like the narcissist can't see anyone else, everything is about them. We don't really understand narcissism too well, like we don't know where it comes from, why it happens. Maybe it's something that's passed down, maybe it's genetic, maybe it's an ancestral trauma, like holistically, spiritually, shamanically, you would call it ancestral trauma, you know, rather than narcissism. And that these traumas get passed down the ancestral line, and these curses and these sort of things that happen to our ancestors become bindings and overshadowings that take over our ancestral line. And then they're just passed down generationally unless someone does the healing work and starts to clear it. And sometimes it's an awful lot to clear. Like, it can be an entire lifetime work just to clear the ancestral line, if at all that is even managed. So it's interesting that it asks the question, you know, where has this sort of narcissism within South Asian families come from? This kind of gaslighting. And what do I mean by that? I mean that often South Asian families are unable to differentiate between the child and them, right? That this is my child. This is a completely formed human being that has all its own hopes and wishes and desires. And I'm just here to caretake, as Rumi said. You know, I'm not here to tell you what to do or to influence you in any way that goes against your will. I'm here to support you. What is it that you want to do? My role as a parent is to support you. South Asian families, as a generalization, don't seem to really understand that. They've decided often from the moment the child is born that they're going to be a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, a politician, you know, something, like something that has a reputation. It's rare that a South Asian family member, for example, would say, oh, I really want my child to be a ballet dancer, or to be a sportsman, or to be an actress, or to be a chef. Like, it's kind of rare that those are an artist. Those are kind of rare places that a South Asian parent tends to go to. I'm generalizing, so just go with me that this is a generalization. And I think if any of you have not experienced that, you are the exception to the rule, and you're very lucky. But usually it's our child is going to be a doctor or a lawyer, an accountant, an engineer, you know, one of these kind of really steady jobs that's going to bring in the money, the parent thinks, and has got respectability around it. And we look at these jobs, we can see that they do have a very colonial bent to them, you know, especially the kind of legal side of things, and even the medical side of things, because it begs the question, you know, the South Asian continent is rife with knowledge when it comes to natural healing, yoga, Ayurvedic healing, Ayurvedic diets, energy healing, like all of it, it's all there, it's amazingly rich. And yet this desire to push the child into medicine which is in many ways a westernized concept, a colonial concept of what healing the body is about, and doesn't take the totality of the body in, which Eastern medicine does. Eastern medicine goes, well, let's look at what's happening spiritually, let's look at what's happening mentally, emotionally, physically, let's pray, let's do a ritual, let's go on pilgrimage, you know, let's fast. Western medicine doesn't do that. So it's a very strange thing that South Asian families want their kids to be doctors. It's so far removed from their heritage, and it kind of speaks of trauma. It speaks of the colonial voice somewhere in the background saying to them, this will be respectable, this will get you accepted, this will give you stability and safety, because at one point there was probably an ancestor that was an energy healer or a yoga practitioner or an Ayurvedic practitioner, and they got burnt or shot or killed or ridiculed or something happened to them, and that got passed down the line, perhaps. I find that very interesting, that the professions that are so, you know, so kind of important to the South Asian family can be quite divorced from the actual culture of being a South Asian person and what that land is about. And then you see, you know, people from the West flocking to India and all over South Asia so they can learn to do yoga, they can learn about Ayurvedic, you know, treatments, so they can fast, so they can go on retreats. I mean, I remember someone saying to me, they gave me an Ayurvedic recipe and they said, so-and-so has told me that you should eat this, it's really good for cleansing. And I was like, mate, this is my heritage. You really don't have to tell me, you as a white person, it's a little bit offensive, you really don't have to tell me what I should be eating, because this is my heritage. I grew up with this, you know, and I had a wonderful grandmother who was into all of this stuff, and her energy infused everything, you know, the kind of herbal teas and stuff. So, and food is your medicine. So it's very interesting, even when we just look at that. But what South Asian families tend to do, so there is that sense that of the narcissist, in the toxicity of the narcissist, they can't separate themselves from the child, that the child is an extension of them. So all their unfulfilled hopes and dreams and wishes get projected onto the child. There's a lot of judgment. There's a lot of criticism. Love is expressed through criticism or judgment. Love, in inverted commas, is expressed through rewards and punishment. If you do this, you get rewarded. If you do this, you get punished. And again, that speaks of colonialism. That speaks of trauma. That speaks of inherited trauma and ancestral trauma. There's a lot of manipulation and a lot of gaslighting and a lot of negating of someone's experiences. You can't be suffering pain because I'm suffering more pain. I mean, the kind of lament of the South Asian elder will be, you know, if you say, oh, I've stubbed my toe, or I've got a cold, or, you know, I've got really bad period pain, will be for them to say, oh, I haven't, you know, my leg's fallen off, or, oh, I haven't eaten in 10 days, or, you know, their pain, their trauma has to be much worse. And there's many, many reasons for that. But again, if we look at it spiritually, could it be that it is this kind of inherited trauma, that it's actually the wail of the ancestors that is coming out from that one mouth that's going, you have no idea what I went through 50, 60, 100 years ago, you know, when our land was taken over and I didn't have food for a year, or, you know, whatever. So I think that it certainly ties into, when we look at the toxicity of South Asian families, it certainly ties into the worth of doing deeper healing work. South Asian families tend to not support their kids if they want to do their own thing. So it's not unheard of and unknown, you know, if the child is like, oh, I want to be a ballet dancer, or I want to go off and be a pop singer or whatever. They really won't support them. They think it's bad work, it's not honourable, it's not going to bring in enough money. And the support will really only come when they've got the big house and the big car and they've won the awards. But if you're a kind of jobbing artist or a travelling nomad, you're going to be treated like the black sheep of the family, the one that didn't quite make it. But if you made it, and made it means money, then you'll get put on the pedestal. One of the really interesting things about toxicity within South Asian families is that, apart from the fact that it does follow patterns, and they are very similar stories, and we could possibly trace this back to inherited ancestral colonial trauma, is that South Asians tend to not do that work. the inner work. I think I've said this before, that I've gone to, you know, I've been on my healing journey for nearly 20 years, and I've sat in so many circles and gone to so many different workshops and retreats and so forth, and I'm usually the only brown face there. And yet the work that is being given to us or being done is often from that part of the world. There's people chanting mantras, you know, we're doing belly dances, there's yoga, there's breath work, there's fasting, there's Ayurvedic principles. And I'm thinking, but why is no one here from the South Asian community doing this work? And for some time I thought, well, maybe it's because they're all just doing it at home, you know, because they've got this innate knowing. But having come across more and more South Asians now and hearing their experiences, and also having a few interactions, very, very few, with South Asian clients, I've come to realize that there seems to be some kind of taboo in even doing the healing work or the inner work. I don't know whether it's cultural or religion specific, that you're not meant to go to someone else, that you should. But all of that is nonsense, because healers and mystics and sages and seers have always been part of the South Asian traditions. You'd always go and see, you know, they'd be your local healer, your local mystic that you would go see. And I think the translation of that has got lost for some reason. And I think it got lost when people left their lands and came to other lands, and possibly were seeking out healers who were of different races, different cultures, spoke different languages, and it felt alien to them and they didn't trust it. And maybe back home they would have gone to their local mosque or their local temple and got their healing, got their advice, got their counselling. But now in a new land they don't want to do that. And then that the trauma of that and the suspicion of healing and the suspicion of inner work then continues to get passed down. It is changing, but I think it's taken a very long time to change. And whereas the black community has kind of burgeoned and grown and flourished, the South Asian community is pretty much lagging behind by a good 5-10 years in terms of seizing opportunities, but also really looking at their trauma and saying, we need to start healing this now. So what I found with a lot of South Asians that I was meeting, but also South Asian clients, was this sort of kind of manipulative tendency, this desire to not do the work, to not pay for it, to try and get as much for free as possible, to shop around, like really kind of old school ways of looking at healing that sort of disintegrated a long time ago and will disintegrate when you're on your journey. But when you're new on your journey and you're kind of a baby to it, you do all these things that are just wastes of time, really, and undermine your own healing. And it's been interesting to notice that. And again, I think that is indicative of South Asian trauma and colonial trauma. So why am I shining a light on this? I'm shining a light on this because, you know, one of the really great things about social media often is hearing and reading people's stories and hearing, I think someone had posted something and then there was like a ton of people, South Asian women mostly, just talking about their experiences with the auntie and the uncle. You know, the uncle that always disapproves of everything that you do, or the auntie that always disapproves, or the parent that always disapproves, or you know, the kind of sibling rivalries that are fueled, often fire is put on them, or the kind of racism within South Asian communities over colour, shades of brown, and how being white is seen as a good thing. And it was great to read these stories, not great because they're good stories, just great to know that you're not alone in your experience. So I'm shining a light on this to say that if you are from a South Asian heritage and you have wondered, why does my family feel a bit odd? Like, why do I feel like the outsider? Or why, when I'm at family gatherings, I've always got that family member, that auntie, that uncle, that cousin, whoever they are, who has to put me down, who has to criticise what I'm wearing or the length of my skirt, or why am I not married yet? Or why have I not had more kids? Or why have I not had a boy yet? You know, whatever it is. And you're feeling like, oh, this is horrible. This is awful. Why has this happened to me? Shining a light on this is to say it's not just you, unfortunately. It is a kind of epidemic within South Asian families. And I think collectively, as a community, we need to find ways to heal this. But individually, we need to find ways to address this. There are no boundaries in South Asian families. You know, you're not allowed to exercise a boundary. You're not allowed to say to a family member, don't do that. Don't speak to me like that. You know, I don't want you in my home. I don't want to see you. This sort of idea that your parents, your family own you. And if they want to come around, they're going to come around. If they want to stay at yours, they're going to stay at yours. If they're going to eat all your food, they're going to eat all your food. You know, and kids grow up in these boundaryless homes, never knowing how to set a boundary. And then it affects South Asians in the world. And I think one of the reasons why, you know, it's tricky for South Asians in the world is because of this colonial trauma and because of this need to people please and this sort of lack of knowledge in what a successful boundary is, because it's just not part of the South Asian experience. It's just not part of how South Asians bring up their children, because I feel that a collective trauma has been passed down. So actually kids are being brought up through trauma, whether that's through discipline, rewards and punishment, or narcissism, or gaslighting, or judgment, or whatever it is. Kids are being brought up in that way, and it's being passed down. There is a whole generation that wants to break that. I don't see enough South Asian clients. I don't get enough of them. I get them make the first move. They'll often be clients that are South Asian or they're Muslim, and they'll make the first move, but when it comes to jumping in, they disappear. Now, I take full responsibility. It could be that I'm not the right healer for them, or my work isn't right for them. But I often feel that it's something else. It's like this fear, the fear of breaking away from your family, the fear of breaking away from your culture and your tradition and doing something different and standing up for yourself. And what will you lose? And the guilt of that and the inherent shaming of that. And I think that is because from a very young age, South Asian children are gaslit, they are shamed, they are guilt-tripped, they are manipulated by traumatized, toxic, narcissistic family members who, do we excuse it, do we say they need healing, whatever, but it creates very damaged individuals that I feel really struggle with their healing. Some of the most toxic, sort of disturbed people I've met have been South Asian, huge generalization, but, you know, in terms of their own identity, in terms of self-love and self-care, in terms of competitiveness, and that their trigger is another South Asian. And that when they're with their white mates, they're completely different because they feel like they've been accepted. With their black mates, they feel like they're part of a crew. But when they're with someone who is of their own heritage, it's like it brings up their own trauma, their unresolved stuff, and then out it all comes. And their behaviour can be really toxic. And you think it wouldn't be like this. You'd think, oh, look, there's another brown person in the room. There's going to be solidarity. 99.9% of the time, that brown person will stab you in the back as soon as they can so they can get accepted by the white person or someone else, like their black group. I'm not the only person to say this. I've had these conversations with quite a few Middle Eastern and South Asian people, and I've said that, you know, we've sort of tentatively skirted around it, and then we've just said it, and we've said, have you noticed that? Have you noticed that there's no solidarity in our community? And that if you're, you know, in a room, if you're on a project, if you're on a job, you're not going to get support. Whereas I think most black people know that when they're in a room, that other black person's got their back, that they're going to like look out for them. And I think, you know, most people know that if you're in a room full of, you know, you're in some room and it's full of white people and there's like one brown face. If the brown face does something, the white people are going to back the white person. I mean, I think we all know this. And I know that, you know, maybe this is going to annoy some people and they're going to go, oh, mass generalization. Well, I can only talk from my own experience. That's what I have experienced in school and in countless jobs and rooms, that I have always been treated like the outsider by the white community. And then, more painfully, treated like an outsider from my own community that is busy trying to fit in and get accepted by their ancestral colonial past, or they're traumatized by it. So it's sort of ingrained in them somewhere. You know, we have to be accepted, we have to fit in. And I think that's why, coming full circle, that's what was always really inspiring about a lot of my black friends at school, is that they weren't looking to do that. They weren't like, oh, I really want to fit in. They were like, my hair's different, you know, my family's different, my food's different, and I'm proud of that. There was the pride. Whereas what I saw with a lot of South Asian kids at school was, I'm different and I hate that and I want to fit in. Of course, that's a generalization, and I think, I know that so many black kids and black people go through so much trauma in school and hair and all of that. I totally know that, but as a non-black person looking at them, I found them inspirational, because they weren't apologising. And yet I felt this often need to apologise. And I remember, you know, being told by my family that you're going to have to work 1,000% harder than anyone else in this country because you're different. And, you know, little statements like that stay with you, because it means that you feel that you don't belong in the room, that you have to work harder, you push yourself harder. And what does that do? It's not great for your well-being, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, physically. And it's not great for self-care. And I think, you know, coming back to that point, why are there so few clients? Why are there so few, you know, people and workshops of South Asian descent? Is it because that we feel that we just don't have the time for that, that we need to be working harder, that we need to just get over this stuff, that it's too self-indulgent for us to sit there and cry over our wounds? Do we have ingrained shame that we don't want to talk about the incredible violence that is in South Asian families? I mean, we still don't talk about that. We still don't talk about the inappropriateness, you know, the dodgy uncles and the dodgy dads and the dodgy brothers that are feeling up their sisters. We don't talk about the violence, the domestic abuse that happens in marriages. We don't talk about the violence, you know, dads beating their kids and mums beating their kids. We don't talk about the punishment and violence system in South Asian families, which is imposed to do with race and to do with religion. Or I'm going to lock you in a room because, you know, your skirt was too short. Or I'm going to not allow you to go here or not allow you to go there. Millions of South Asian kids that aren't allowed to have sleepovers, see their friends, go on holiday, listen to certain types of music. All the things that most people take for granted can very easily be denied in South Asian families. And what that does to a child is deeply traumatic. If you're not allowed to pick up the phone and chat to your friend or have a sleepover or go on, you know, a school trip or go on holiday with your mates or whatever it is that everyone else is doing, and the reason you're not allowed to do it is because your South Asian parents think it's dishonourable or it goes against your religion or it goes against your race, or they're suffering some kind of, you know, post-colonial trauma that's been passed down and they don't trust the white man, or they don't trust the world. It's really traumatic. And you don't get those experiences. It's really rare that you have those experiences in white families. You know, I know very few adults who will talk about their childhood and say, I wasn't allowed to do things. Yes, their parents, you know, disciplined them and they snuck out and went to the local club or whatever, and they did drugs secretly and they had underage sex or whatever it was that they did secretly. But it wasn't the same. When you talk to South Asian kids, you know, this is proper under house arrest, not allowed to do anything. And that somehow in that sort of very suffocating environment, they have to find their identity. And for many South Asians, you know, they don't find their identity until they move far away from home, you know, until that bond is really stretched to its limit. And the really tough thing is that South Asian families put so much guilt on their kids. Their kids are meant to look after them into old age. Their kids are meant to be certain ways, that they're being bad kids if they move away. And I think this is every individual's journey, but you have to decide, you know, is being close to your family healthy for you? Or is it something that harms you? And if it harms you, then there'll always be a wound within wanting that closeness. But it's better that you create your own family away from that toxicity rather than stay within it, because it is so suffocating and it is so detrimental. And I know from the stories that I've heard and experiences that I've had myself that, you know, it's not conducive to being in your power, to being in your strength, to being creative, to being happy. It's not conducive. So I'm shining a light on it because I think more lights need to be shone on it, and we need to be having these conversations a lot more than we do. And I can talk about it because I come from South Asian heritage, and so I feel that I can talk about it. And often we have people that don't come from specific heritages talking about stuff, passing judgment on what racism is and what racism isn't, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But you can't really talk about it unless you've experienced it. Everything else is a concept. So yes, you can talk about it, freedom of speech, but it is a concept, and I'd rather hear a lived experience dissection of an argument than a concept from someone who's observed it or read it in a book. If you are from South Asian heritage and any of this resonates with you, the core wound healing work is probably going to be the most useful on my website if you're thinking of offerings. But any kind of inner work is going to be really necessary if you grew up in a family like that, and really important and ongoing. And self-care and boundaries. And whoever you seek out for that help, you know, whether you seek a therapist or a coach or a mentor, however you do that, navigate your place in the world, is vital. And that through the healing work, you know, one of the things that I've had a very cyclical journey with is that you don't throw out everything. You don't throw out all your traditions and all the stuff that's great. You keep what's great. What didn't work, you recycle or you upcycle. You know, that you don't turn against your heritage. You don't try and be white or try and be black or try and be something else. You just be you. And you accept that you being you is South Asian, and that you're not letting anyone down, and that you haven't done anything wrong, and that you're not letting your family down, which is, I think, a huge weight that South Asian families put on their children. The website is sacredspacehealing.org. That's sacredspacehealing.org. Wherever you are on your journey, I wish you much joy, love, peace, and abundance. Until the next time.